Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 705. Guys, what do we have for the Nerdist Community Corp
Board? I feel like he's going on a bit of a journey. It's also full of local references, so everyone will be mad. This guy, Corey Darcy, or Desi, is just moved to Los Angeles as part of following his dream. That dream involves working for Ripley's, believe it or not.
I don't believe it.
Well, you should.
Why?
Because Corey's part of it.
And
so he's real.
It.
He's corporeal.
Oh, not.
I want to... Well, actually, this all fits into this. So he moved out here to become a general manager of the one on Hollywood and Highland that has the T-Rex with the sunglasses on right now.
Yes.
And they're having, like, low attendance, so we've got a hookup for Nerdist fans. If you mention Nerdist at the gateway, you know, to get into Ripley's, they are going to get you in for the kids' price.
What?
To all Nerdist listeners.
Okay, say this. You could either just mention Nerdist, or you could say say this phrase. Nerdist has decreed that I am a child, and therefore wish to pay a child's admission price.
Corey, this is what you wanted. Just remember that this is going to happen every
Nerdist
day.
Nerdist has decreed that I am a child, and therefore demand to pay the children's admission price. Believe it or not, I hope it is the former.
Please do that. Yeah, please, as loud as possible with all those staccato stops. And if you could add a suck in before the or not for a bonus, believe it or not.
You know who's on this episode of the podcast?
Who?
Paul Rudd with a double D.
What?
Yes,
double
Paul
D's
Rudd
in?
Is finally on the podcast.
Oh, Ruddy.
God damn it, he's delightful.
I hate that he is five times more handsome than I thought he'd be and funnier than anyone I've ever met.
So great.
Oh.
Yeah, this was this is promoting Ant-Man, which is wonderful. It's so good. You know, if you're a little fatigued from like super blow-em-up superhero movies, this was a really nice, intimate kind of a heist movie.
I'm really excited for it.
Ant-Man was really great. Lydia and I saw it at the premiere about a week and a half ago. And so I highly recommend it. Comes out today. You could go see it in a theater, today being the 17th of July.
I might go do that.
I don't care about your life.
Aw.
I don't want your life. I don't know. I still say.
Why are you James Vanderbilt?
I'm so glad you got that.
It's reference. Varsity Blues. You can't forget Varsity Blues.
I don't want your life.
The best was the trailer. Whatever. Well, Brown, we're just doing sit-ups, debating what college to go to.
And that was really Friday Night Lights before Friday Night Lights,
yeah.
Right?
Except yeah. Way dumber, like, and kind of terrible.
Was it? So long ago. I went to the premiere of Varsity.
Did you?
Blues.
Of course you did.
I did.
That came out right in the height, that sweet spot of where I watched MTV, and was just like, this movie and Cruel Intentions seem really important.
It was one of the few premieres that I got invited to, so even though it was a sports movie, I went.
It had Not a Surf's popular in the trailer. I remember
yes.
A lot about Varsity Blues.
Yes. Oh my God. Amazing. I'm so glad that you got that reference. Maybe I do want your laugh. Wait, I got my own Netflix. Okay, I'm back to not wanting your laugh no more. I don't want your laugh no
I like
more.
The idea that he just says that to everyone until he finds someone whose life he does like, then he kills them and takes their life.
I have a grande frappuccino.
Oh, I want that guy's laugh. This stupid skinny caramel macchiato was a bad call.
This is the most I've laughed about Varsity Blues since the 1900s. So here we go, Nerdist Podcast number 705 with Mr. Paul Rudd.
And his laugh.
I want his laugh. Katie, roll the thing. I want your laugh. I want your laugh having to roll the thing, Katie. I can't stop now. I don't want my own laugh right now.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We'll be right back.
How are you?
I saw you yesterday kind of in my peripheral vision. I was like, oh, I want to say hey.
No, I just didn't want to. I figured... You know, there was a second I was like, I'm going to go say hi to Paul. And then I was like, everyone has that thought, and I don't want to...
Not at all. I was bummed that I missed you, but I knew I'd probably be seeing you today, so that's okay.
First of all, I loved the shit out of the movie. It was so much fun.
Oh, man.
It was so much fun. I think it's such a... I think one of the things, besides the fact that it's hilarious and you know, and everyone's great in it, and I thought Peyton did a great job, it's coming off of Avengers... It's such a, like, Avengers is so heavy and so so intense and so explosion-y.
So huge in scope and scale.
Yes.
Yeah.
That it's nice just to have, like, oh, it's like a fun heist movie, but it happens to be a superhero and everyone's funny.
Right. Oh, that's nice. Yeah. I thought it would be kind of like a nice antidote to all that huge, massive explosions in the sky and all of that kind of thing. And yeah, I'm glad that you dug it.
Have you seen it? Had you seen it a bunch before?
It was the first time I saw it.
Are you serious?
I saw an early version, but it was kind of before the effects were in. So then last night was the really like the first time I saw it with everything. And that was a kind of a unique way of seeing it. But it was cool. It was really great. I was there with my kid too. So my son, who's 10. He'd never even seen me in a movie. So it was
really.
Yeah.
Not one.
No, not one. He's never really shown much of an interest, and I've never had any interest in showing them. But this one, it was kind of like in his wheelhouse, and you know, and he was really saying he wanted to go to the premiere and everything, and so
I think you need to be the kind of dad that forces your son to, like, you basically every night is you doing an anthology of your career. It's like, you know, it's like
this is it. Yeah, it'll be like DVD commentaries. Watch, we had a lot of fun. I remember when we were doing this scene. He's just dad.
I need to go to the bathroom.
Just 5 more minutes. Hold on. All right, this is an important scene.
The thing you have to understand about Clueless is that it's actually the story of this other Shakespearean
of Emma, yeah, which we're gonna watch next, but we'll fast forward through that one because I'm not in it. But when we get back to Clueless, you'll see the comparison.
Oh yeah, that's actually, I meant Jane Austen. But it's you know, I actually was at the Clueless premiere because I was working at MTV at that time.
On the beach.
Yes, on the beach. Yes, they did the whole thing on the beach.
Yeah.
And it was the Luscious Jackson played.
That's right.
I was there.
That's crazy.
It really was crazy. Because that was sort of that's when MTV kind of like really started aligning themselves with movies.
Yeah, it was the whole thing was just so new to me. I mean, I never even like been to anything like that. But like a movie premiere.
Right.
So that was, I just remember we all rode out there together. We were all in like a stretch limo.
Oh, yeah. A stretch limo going to the beach.
Yeah, that's a pretty smooth way to do it.
I mean, it's like a prom after party in a weird sort of way. We're going to the beach, you guys.
Yeah, we're going to the beach. And I do remember like no one really watched the movie.
You mean at the thing?
At the thing, yeah.
Because now it's, I mean, like Clueless is one of those. You've been in a lot of movies that are kind of like cultural touch points, like movies that are quotable, or oh my god, I watched that movie like 500 times when I was, you know, like you've managed to find parts and films that are so much a part, like
it's dumb luck.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't. I think it could be luck one time, but I don't think it could be luck. I mean, I feel like it's not. Like, you know, John Hughes wasn't lucky over and over again. He just knew, you know.
Right, right. Well, you know, I think some of it is also just kind of meeting up with people kind of at a certain point, and then, you know, you never really know what these things are going to turn out to be like, or like in the case of something like Wet Hot American Summer, where it was just I was friends with those guys, but also just read that script and thought like, this is really funny. I don't know if anyone will ever see it, but you know, that kind of humor landed and lasted. And same thing with Anchorman, or, you know, and the Apatow thing. It is true. I think over time, you know, looking back, it's weird that, and very cool to have been in movies where some of the lines in the movies, like, you see them on t-shirts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're just in the culture. They just bleed over into the culture, and they're also, They're almost like secret club passwords. Yeah. You know, like if someone says that at a party and someone else responds with the next line, you're like, okay, now we're in a secret club together.
By the way, I love how I just came in and it's like, we're doing this now.
Doing this for almost 10 minutes.
I love it. It's great. Yeah, I went to the bathroom, came back, and then we just sat down and it's just right in it.
Now,
hit the ground running. I know how it all works here.
Well, no, but I also, you know, I also just don't want to, like, I hate it. I don't like formal.
Yeah.
I hate formal anything.
I know.
I would rather have a conversation with someone than have them feel like they're being interviewed. And yesterday on the red carpet, I had nothing to do with the movie, and every interview that I did, people were like, if you could be, what superhero would you be?
Right.
And what if you could be the size of an insect, what would you?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I just got asked that like 6 times. Paul Rudd, now you've opened the door. This is part of your existence now.
So weird, you know, it's the same questions over and over again. And you would think, knowing that, even knowing that beforehand, I would have formulated some kind of answer that is gonna be the right thing to say, and I just don't. I don't think it through. There's also that thing of just wanting to answer the same question differently, so you feel as if, like, okay, I want to be present in this thing, and I don't want to just kind of regurgitate the same stuff. But sometimes I feel like even just the way that interviews are in general over the course of a career, all I've done is just regurgitated the same stuff. And I don't even know if I buy it anymore. I don't think half of it is true. Sometimes I'll go back and I'll think, okay, this has kind of been the answer. I gave this answer once and maybe I just kind of believe it now. But that's not completely accurate, and I don't know what's true anymore, or it's just I've become a characterization of myself.
Well, it's just sort of a strange thing to have to. I mean, I can't think of other occupations where you would sit down, like if someone was like a manager of a grocery store, you wouldn't be like, if you could be any piece of produce, what would you know, like to answer that? I'd be lettuce. You know, like there's no. And I started doing this thing where I knew I was going to get asked the question over and over again. I knew I was going to give the same answer because I had this weird crossroads in my brain of, well, if I give different answers, does that nullify the previous answer? And then but then am I an idiot if people just see the same answer over and over again?
Right.
So the more I answered it, oddly, the more I deliberated when they would ask me. So by the sixth time, I knew I was going to say, well, I would be a combination of Wolverine and Spider-Man. And I would still go, oh, man.
What would it be? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I got to say, I really like Wolverine. But, you know, Spider-Man, like, I always have that. Like, it got more complex.
You were actually bullshitting yourself even more.
Completely.
And, yeah. You don't want to offend. You don't want to feel like you have that answer already on deck.
No. Chris Hardwick, what are you? Wolverine and Spider-Man. Are we done? Like, I don't want
to. I'm opposite. Like, you know, it's funny. I've actually, I was asked that same question like a week ago. And I thought it was maybe like, you know, back then I was thinking Wolverine and Spider-Man. Yeah.
But then someone made me address the mechanics of it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess every time I would go to shoot webs, claws would rip through my hands because the mechanism to fire both things was probably the same reflex. And then it would just be a lot of like, oh, fuck. And I would have to heal before I could shoot.
You'd have to figure out some new technology to make that coexist.
Yeah. It wasn't well thought out.
Do you have now, because, you know, you are a funny guy and it is part of your, I think, in your DNA, do you like to? You will sometimes say things just for to entertain yourself as an answer or something. And has it ever gotten you in trouble? Do you ever sit on an answer because you know it's just so inappropriate?
Yes. But I also find that I think one thing that I'm knocking on wood. One thing that I think I'm strangely good at is not being threatening. So if I say something,
right,
I just from having done stand up for almost 20 years, I know a lot of times, even if I know it's kind of going into a zone that maybe it shouldn't go, that there's enough of a tether back that someone's not going to feel like they've been cold slapped with a complete, you know,
yeah, Yeah.
And especially now, of course, you know that what happened during the last press tours and then...
It's so tricky. I mean, now it's there are so many outlets and sound bites. They look for sound bites that even a thing that isn't... It isn't even a thing.
Yeah.
It isn't even a sound bite. It isn't... It's like a throwaway comment that could be the third comment of a bit that's been going on, that they will seek that out and try and make it into a story that just kind of catches on. It's so tricky now.
Tonight on Entertainment Tonight, Paul Rudd says Hitler is rad. No, I was, I'm not sure. Yeah. Like, there's no way to back
that. Yeah, and then you could say like, well, I mean, I only said it because it is true. Hitler's kind of rad. And then you clearly, the joke is there, but the joke doesn't come across in print.
No, but I think people like you and I have it a little bit easier in the sense that people know you're a comedy guy in addition to being an actor. They know, like, okay, well, Paul, and they also know that that you're good at playing the character who can say something ridiculous very straight and it's funny. And so I think people do expect that from you, and when you have that context, because when you see some of the stuff that gets dissected now, you go, well, you know, if you just watch an episode of South Park, there's like things that are a million times worse, but
right.
People have already contextualized that as like, yeah, but that's their thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think it's context.
Yeah. I hope it's, I hope you're right in that. Maybe I'll be let off the hook a little bit because they know that I've just, you know, I give a lot of jackass answers.
Maybe. Well, I think that in the older days of media, I think, you know, like watching someone in the public a lot was a little bit like a tightrope act. And now I feel like there's still the tightrope act, but then everyone in our culture is going,
oh yeah.
Up, he's got a bell. Look at him, fucking idiot. You know, like
it's
now,
true.
Now there's a little bit of that too. So it's people kind of want to be the thing that tips it. I'm listening to this amazing, because I don't have time to sit down and read a book, so I have to listen to it just in my car. But this book by a guy named John Ronson called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and it's all about just the culture of shaming that we're in now. And,
right,
and it's really fascinating.
It's really aggressive.
It's very...
It's true.
But you're so likable, though. I feel like you'd have to say something really bad for people to...
I don't know. You know, when I'm having this thought as we're talking about this. I think back to, you know, the first press junket I was ever a part of, like this premiere thing you were talking with Clueless. I was at a round table. They call them round tables, mm-hmm. where there are all of these journalists sitting around. They ask questions, and no one knew who I was, nor should they. It was like the first movie that ever came out that I was in, and I was self-conscious, and I felt bad that all these people had to spend their day asking, like spending, like with a kid, asking questions. But I remember there was one guy who was so visibly bored and didn't want to be there and a part of it. And somebody had asked me the question, well, now that you're part of a big Hollywood movie, are you going to go and hit all the Hollywood hotspots? And and I just said, no, I don't think so. Probably not. And it was right after the whole thing with Hugh Grant had happened.
Oh, wow.
And one of the other journalists had said, oh, so you're not going to be... going out with Hugh Grant anytime soon, and everyone just kind of chuckled. And I said very straight faced, "Oh no, but you know, I think I've used that whore before." And no one like knew how to like no, there was no. People were visibly like, what the hell did I just say?
The air just went
completely, except the one guy who was bored the entire time looked up to me and kind of smiled. He got the joke, and it was like, all right, that's the only guy I care about. And
now,
and I think like now, you say that now, which I just said it now, that would be over.
Yeah, yeah.
Over. That would be the worst. It's that thing of just say that. The thing that seems unsayable, just say it.
I mean, I think on the one hand, you know, I mean, when people make jokes, if they don't land, it's unfortunate that our culture doesn't have the ability to just eye roll a little bit and go like, okay, wise guy. Now
yeah.
It's like, strip him, stir him down, hit him with the hose.
Yeah, there really is. I feel bad for comedians that are. Although it seems like most comedians don't care. Like
they do care.
They do care if they're getting kind of publicly excoriated over
absolutely.
Something they might say.
Someone that, just the was it The Guardian? Someone just dug up something from Amy Schumer and said she's it basically called her a racist because she did a couple of old bits that she had that were about Latino culture and. She got called out for that, and it was like they dug this thing up, which I get. I mean, I don't know. And she wrote a whole thing like, I haven't, I haven't written a joke about race in over 2 years. I'm a comedian. I try to take the piss out of things. I'm not, I'm a feminist and I work for equality for everyone, and I'm not, And she had to defend herself, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about. Jokes is you could joke about what's you're not supposed to joke about so that we can all laugh and it not be so taboo.
And it's hard because if you if you break down anything there's something horrible at the seed of it, which is sort of why so people go, oh, so it's funny to make fun of whatever, someone who died in a fire. No, it wouldn't be literally funny to go, but this
I would argue you're actually doing the opposite. You're actually doing a public service by, bringing this up and making people identify with it and have an actual conversation. And
And also, my dad died of a heart attack. My grandfather died of cancer. My stepfather died of a heart attack. If someone comes into a room, they're like, hey, guys, don't have a heart attack, but I'm not going to go, wait a minute.
And I mean, same thing. My dad died of cancer, and the way that I deal with it, the way that I grieve, I mean, it's awful. I miss him like crazy, but I say the worst stuff. Like really bad, bad things about him and about cancer and the fact that he is dead, and it makes me laugh.
Yeah, I feel like I get to own this joy. Where if I'm in a room and someone says something and blah blah blah, your dad, and I'm like, oh, my father who died, it's just I can't help it. It just and I think he would have thought that was funny too.
Absolutely, he would have.
So it's and I feel like there's something that's. Very natural about owning the tragedy that way, because obviously I don't want my father to be dead, but he's dead, so what else am I supposed to what else can I do with it to process it? He wouldn't want me to be just sad in a room all the time. Of course I have those days, but it kind of feels like this is part of a it helps me feel connected to him to be able to sort of.
Yeah, because you could say that and you could just see him laughing at that.
Yes, yes. And in stand up when I talk about his death, if there's a piece that people don't laugh at, I go, well, you're disrespecting his memory right now. And it's fine.
How dare you?
How dare you? He's dead and he deserves better, He's not alive. How dare you? And it's just a fun thing to be able to do. Of course I would prefer that he's here, but he's not. So I'm glad that, first of all, it's great to meet someone else in the Dead Dad Club and also not great at the same time.
Right. But that is interesting there. You do – when you find that kind of commonality where it's like you get weirdly excited where it's like, oh, sweet, your dad's dead too. Right on. How did your world fall off of its axis?
Okay, it's going to be a bummer for a while and then funny for like a week.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it'll be a bummer again. And I do hope people understand that this is part of the grieving process. This is how we deal with horrible things in the world. And I feel like it's a wonderful mechanism that our brains have. Because if we didn't have this, there's so much tragedy, you would never get out of bed, you would never be motivated to
do anything. Truly, like laughing, like legitimately finding something funny and laughing is the best thing in the world. It's the best thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that it also makes me feel like I feel safe with that too. There's something that makes me feel more comfortable with the idea of death. And I tell people when I die, please do ridiculous things with my body because I will be dead and it won't matter, And so I think it's a much healthier relationship than like, hey. I mean, I wouldn't comment on someone else's experience, but I feel like I can comment. This is how I deal with it. And fuck you if you don't like it.
Yeah.
When did you lose your dad?
We'll see. He died, like, I guess, like, almost six years ago, I guess. Six years ago, yeah.
Yeah. And was it?
So I mean, long enough to know that I had to think about it.
That you had to think about it.
Yeah.
It does get, yeah, mine was almost 2 years ago, and that's very weird because I feel like if there's a part of my brain, the part of your brain that doesn't understand time.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, he just, oh, yeah, no, it's been a couple of years.
I feel like 2 years is the timeline. That's the time span for anything, to get used to anything.
I'm like still a death noob.
Yeah, no, you're just now getting out of it. I remember when my dad died, I talked to another friend of mine. My dad had been dead for about a week, and everyone, and no one knows that. Yeah, he was a week down, and then people don't know how what to say to you. No one knows what to say when somebody has died. They don't know how to deal, and some people do. But I just remember my friend Matt saying like 2 years. He put a time limit on it. He goes, 2 years. You're going to be sad for 2 years. After 2 years, you're going to be able to think about him, and you'll be happy. You'll smile at the thought of him and not just cry. And he goes, and you'll never get over it, but you will get through it, and it'll be 2 years. And I feel like, all right, that kind of makes sense. I feel like it takes, like, if you move somewhere, it takes 2 years before you feel like that's your home. Maybe it's just 2 years is the time frame for anything.
2 years, yeah. I adapt. I would often think 18 months would be, especially, you know, like in this business that we work in, 18 months is about the time it takes for something to bear fruit. Like a thing that you start working on today or a thing that you pitch today, like in 18 months, you'll see the results of it. But I, in the first week after it happened, do you know Ike Barinholtz?
Yeah.
So Ike did Talking Dead, and it had just happened like the week, I think maybe the week before. And I ran into him in the hallway before the show, and he was like, oh man, I'm sorry. Is there anything I can do? And I just grabbed him really hard, and I was like, can you bring my dad back to life? And Ike, who's like, I've never seen Ike at a loss for words ever. And it was the first time he was like, I don't know.
He should have just put his lips close to your ear and said, yes,
come with me. I am your friend. And then,
yeah, you got $10,000.
It's not cheap. How bad do you want them back?
It's going to cost you.
I mean, you'd buy a fancy computer, right? Well, what if that computer was your father? You would spend $10,000 on your dad, wouldn't you? I mean, how much do – what are we really talking about here?
Is there a thing – where they say, like, okay, you can have your debt. You have to give this up, and you have to give this. You cannot have any money for the rest of your life.
Right.
You will not have a career. You cannot get married or have children.
Sure.
Would you give that back? Would you give that up for getting your dad back?
This, by the way, is the beginning of the greatest game show that I want to pitch.
What's the cutoff?
What's the number?
So I don't have a career?
Not at all. No career.
No career. You have to, and this is what, and not only do you not have a career, you have to, like, the shittiest job. Where are you like, all right, you know what? He can stay dead. I have to at least, you know.
You have to be like a shit messenger where you go to different doctor's office and just take stool samples to labs. And that's as good as it ever gets.
Do you know the answer, but before you give it, do you pause like you're giving your Wolverine Spider-Man answer?
Oh, man.
Let me think about that
one. God, you know, Dad was, he was a fighter, but I feel like, I mean,
he lived a good life. He lived a good long life.
I mean, I wonder at what point would you start to make the selfish decisions that you would try to make sound like they were more altruistic, like... Well, you know, Dad said he never wanted to get, like, old.
That's right.
You know? So, like, I think it was better that he died at 72 because he just never got old.
You know, my dad always said he wanted me to drive an Audi Q7.
He said the performance package was very important.
He really wanted that for me.
And
I feel like I might be disgracing him.
And I would argue with him and go, but I don't need seat heaters in L.A. And he'd be like, but I want you to have – it's very important.
It gets cold.
Yeah.
It's that people think L.A. is just hot and sunny all the time. It's not. You need those seat warmers.
It gets down to like 50, 55 in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And it's like that's very cold here because we're a dry climate. So I really feel like he would really want me to have the ultimate driving experience.
So instead, you'll just drive around, and you'll every time you have a warm ass, you'll think about Dad.
I'm doing the thing he would have wanted. I'm living it right now. Yeah, it's that would be the most amazing game show.
It really are, because like there is a cutoff.
Oh, of course there is.
Like, yeah. That does exist.
There is a cutoff, and I feel like it. I feel like it. It's way more selfish than most people would want to admit that it was, you know. So if
wait a minute, I can never eat pasta?
Okay, because what are you counting as pasta? I mean, does that count like Vietnamese vermicelli noodles? I mean,
is gnocchi in there?
Kind of a pasta. my dad loved ravioli. He loved it so much. Okay, so if I get my dad back, so my dick never works again? Oh, I mean, he would never want that.
That is. That's the topic. I mean, that's where we go with this.
I'm in my early 40s. I feel like I got a lot of use out of that. I mean, my dad's great, but he's just going to get older and older and older, you know?
I mean, he's going to have to die someday.
I mean, is it fair that
am I getting him back for, like, 3 years?
Should both our dicks not work for the rest of his borrowed time? Like, it's not fair.
Yeah.
It's not. I don't think he would want that. That's This is important.
This is real stuff.
Do you have the type of relationship? I would imagine that your family, you probably can be. You can make these.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I never felt that I couldn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are they all? Is your family pretty funny?
Yeah, they're pretty funny. They're pretty funny.
Yeah.
Let's not get out of hand. All right. No, my dad was hilarious. No, we lost the funniest guy.
Oh, shit.
My mom is...
Are you happy now? You're the funniest one. Well, what?
My mom has always had a good, sick sense of humor, for sure, and would absolutely appreciate the most off-color thing that I could possibly say. And
yeah.
She'd roll with it, and same with my sister. And that's who's left. It was just the four of us, and now it's the three of us. So I always felt very comfortable about, you know, saying the unsayable, for sure.
But your parents were British, right?
Yeah.
So that I feel like that's very much a part of British culture too, is being able to is like, oh, you've said the thing you shouldn't say.
Yeah, they were both very liberal, and they were European. I mean, even though they, you know, I was born here, and they moved over. I guess my mom left England when she was about 18 or so, and then my dad was 9. So, and he grew up kind of just right outside New York City. But they had that European sensibility, and certainly with the humor. I mean, I grew up kind of watching Monty Python and Fawlty Towers, and they would always make a point of sitting me down, and we'd watch those shows when they were on, you know, public television when they were airing.
God, I got so lucky because my dad watched Hee Haw. And it just like, well, I did not, my dad.
Hee Haw was a show that I would put on, and I always say, like, it seems like I should like this, but I just don't like this.
No, it's not good. You know what? I'm glad he's dead. No, I'm sorry. No, but it.
I don't. Yes. Did it? See, already, just have the joke that formulates, so, like, I'm not going to say it because it's about your dad.
No, you can tell. You can make. No, because then, you know, the problem with that is that the one. The one caveat to the whole thing is that it's like, I'm allowed to joke about my dad, you're allowed to joke about your dad, but then when people hear this, sometimes people don't understand how humor works.
Right.
And they forget that comedy is like a broadsword, and some people can wield it, and other people are just like, and so I'll get people that'll say things on Twitter like, your dad's dead, and I'll be like, okay, well, maybe that's not...
Yeah, and you know, you can tell by also, like, whoever is saying it, you get their vibe,
right?
You kind of get a sense of who they are, and you could, in that split second, you're like, okay, you can say that, but you can't
say that. I can tell
in the way that you just are that you can joke about my dad.
No, you just there was a little bit of poison on the sword there on that when you said it. It wasn't.
Yeah, that's what seemed to be lacking in all kind of humor and
you're
compassion.
Not helping me deal with this in any way. You're just kind of finger pointing and laughing right now, which is a little bit different.
So he was a Hee Haw fan.
He liked Hee Haw, and so my parents never... I discovered, you know, Python and all that stuff. My parents knew I was a comedy fan, so they would buy me all sorts of comedy stuff. But if you know, my dad was the one that called me in the early 2000s, and he was like, have you seen this blue-collar comedy? Because
you are from the South, and I think you'd really appreciate it. And I'm like, I feel like it's designed so that everyone has an entry point into what they're selling. I never would have been able to explain the UCB to my dad.
Right.
It always just sort of, and he was very sweet about it, but when I would try to explain the alternative comedy scene, it always just sounded like, none of us get paid. Like, it always sounded like, we made our own little community, and that's how we, I know it's not that, you know, it never sounded right.
I was really lucky. I think that as a kid, I just remember sitting around listening to 2000-Year-Old Man records, and my dad had a Bob and Ray record to. And so I took to comedy pretty early. I'm not a comedian, and I don't do stand-up, and I didn't study sketch at, like, UCB or Second City or any of that, but I've always been drawn to comedy for sure. And I wonder, like, why, and it maybe had to do with moving around a lot or having European parents and not, you know, feeling like always feeling maybe a little bit on the outside, really trying to deconstruct what it is that I loved about it. But I was obsessed with comedians and I would obsess about comedy. Yeah.
Who did you like the best?
I think Steve Martin, you know, when I was just of that age when those records came out, and just seeing, you know, hearing this guy talking for a living and being a grown up telling this absurd stuff and then the jerk and all that, I was obsessed. Just loved
Steve.
Yeah,
me too.
Martin.
I'm 2 years younger than you are, so I'm in the same. That was.
I find
like
that he's
same.
Kind of the, he is the common ground that so many people of our generation, and the thing that I've noticed about a lot of comedy fans, it's he's the lightning rod. That those records and that wild and crazy guy persona and all of that were so instrumental to so many people. I mean, I think that I saw Carlin perform a few times, and I think Carlin might be my favorite.
Yeah.
As an adult, and I loved him growing up too. And I loved so many different comedians. I think that the Steve Martin records were probably the genesis for a lot of it.
Have you worked with him?
No.
Have you ever met him?
I've met him, but I've never had any kind of real conversation, just because I don't want him to feel as if he needs to talk to me.
Right.
you know what I mean?
So that's why you show up to the thing with the bunny ears.
I just say hello, and he's always been very nice, but I don't really try and engage. I just, you know, because I'd like to give him his kind of privacy. And
yeah,
the guy's
that's true.
Been dealing with so many fawning fans. And,
oh, yeah. You know. I mean, and I've fortunately had a very good Groundhog Day moment with him, which I know I've talked about on the podcast before, but I met him 12 or 13 years ago at the Aspen Comedy Festival, and I did the ultimate thing that I shouldn't have done. You're the best singer. Yeah. And all the, you're all the reason I, you know, and then he shut down, and then, I also have the comfort knowing that he'll never remember that.
Right.
So I met him again this year for a minute, and I was much more like, hey, nice to meet you. And I got a do-over.
Right.
And I felt really cool about it.
Yeah. I mean, I have friends that are very friendly with him and know him, and you know, everyone really likes him. I have the coolest thing that I think I have is, just to backtrack a second, when I met Judd Apatow, I was at a dinner. I was talking about fake names, and I said one of the greatest fake names of all time was Gern Blanston. And I then got really boring and broke it down as to why that's a great fake name. But but one of the people that was at the dinner said, oh, that explains Judd Apatow's email address. And this was like when people were first getting email. I'd never met Judd. So I just went, I think all there was AOL. And I think I went home and just typed Gern Blanston at AOL and wrote Judd a letter, and then he wrote me back, and we were kind of pen pals for a year before we ever even met.
That's amazing.
Anyway, I told that story, and I want to say it was in the New York Times or it was in a newspaper. When Born Standing Up, Steve Martin's book came out, and I bought it the day it came out, and I read it, you know, in one sitting. I mean, as so many people did. That week in the mail, I got a letter, an envelope. I opened it up, and it was that book. And I opened it front page, and it said, "To Paul, with respect, Steve Martin, and in parentheses, Gurn.
Oh, that's amazing.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I had a Gurn Blanson screen name too.
You did too.
I did too. Yeah.
You go deep.
I did. I had a Gurn Blanson was one, and then Nathan Thurm, which was a character that
Martin Short
played.
A brilliant character with the long cigarette ash.
Well, you
think it's so funny that you'd say that.
you're the one who's nervous.
Yeah, I'm not nervous. It's so funny that you think I'm Seraphis.
And I love that in the sort of the Justice League of comedians, it brings me so much joy that they are friends.
Yes. Yes. Great friends. I love seeing all of those, you know, shows where they're honoring each other. And Martin Short always gives some killer speech and just roasts them. And he can get away with it.
God, He is so. I mean, some people can write funny, and Martin Short is just.
Oh, he fucking, just breathes just and exudes like, funny and joy, and he is in just the rarest of rarefied air. Martin Short is a national treasure.
How can he be that?
Even though he's Canadian,
yeah,
he lives here now. I think he's a world. He's a global treasure.
He's a treasure and a traitor. For not being from America.
Mm.
But other than that, he's really great. That's fine. He's from America's hat. Oh, here come the fucking tweets now. I don't know. I'm just kidding. We're just kidding. Please. If you were going to get madder at me about that than me talking about my dead father. Fuck you and your dead father. Canada rules. Oh, no. Eh? Like, this is going to be really shitty. Did you? I wonder sometimes if... Because you are an actor, but you do so many things that are so strongly comedic, have you ever felt like when you go to do something more serious that people are just kind of looking at you like, when are you going to do the funny thing?
I feel like now.
Yeah.
It's maybe a bit more of an uphill climb than it ever used to be. Because I never, you know, before Anchorman, I would do some comedies here and there, but I did a lot more serious stuff. And then Anchorman was a bit of a... you know, tidal shift. I then met all those guys and I was able to kind of continue in that world. And I love comedy. And I think I've probably been typecast to a, you know, pretty good amount. And I have never really gone the Daniel Day-Lewis route of really trying to be completely different from role to role.
Call me Ant-Man on the set.
Yeah. Not that I have the talent to be that different from role to role, but it has been a fairly narrow window. I recognize that over the last 10 years. And
you just made me think that if Daniel Day-Lewis was in a superhero movie, if he played like Loki or something, if he would make everyone call him Loki on set and only talk to people like this.
And carry around that thing. Get there early. Get there early. Was it on the Crucible where, he showed up to that set, I think a month early, built the set. He built it. Sat around whittling and doing things, and it's just, God, that is such commitment.
But the undertone of it is like, don't be a dick. Come on. You can just show up and act, you know? And he's amazing. I mean, that's the thing.
He's the greatest actor we have, right? I mean, I really think so. I'm a huge fan. I remember...
Thank God he's not terrible that no one would tolerate
I remember... Nick Heitner, who is now the artistic director of the National Theatre in London, is Sir Nicholas Heitner, who directed that movie. I worked with not long after he did The Crucible. We were doing Twelfth Night at Lincoln Center, and I was asking him questions about Daniel Day-Lewis because he had worked on The Crucible, and he said, he's telling me all the stories about, yes, he did come there early, like how method he is and how wonderful he is and what a great guy. And he's a huge fan of Paul Scofield, who was in the film. And Paul Scofield showed up and was looking at his script and saying the lines the lines like, "Well, John, what do you say now? Well, John, what do you say now?" And thinking about how he's going to say the line, he said, the look of horror on Daniel Day-Lewis's face. just the guy he admired more than anyone.
Was like a newscaster.
The opposite approach to what he did. It was, yeah, he goes, I'll never forget the look on Danny's face.
But then, of course, he would have had to have been conflicted because if Daniel Day-Lewis was in his character for the movie, then he wouldn't understand what that was.
Oh, yes.
There's so many
layers to
this. So many ways to poke holes in that.
Oh, boy.
So I would never, this just doesn't sound like a fun job to have to just completely immerse yourself in a thing and have to be in the.
When I got out of acting school and was just, you know, in that mindset of writing out everything, you know, all my character's bio before I did everything and like going to the location, you're learning. I mean, I really was trying to learn the best approach and learn my technique. I'd always hear about technique and I didn't have a technique. I don't know if I still have a technique, but all of that sounded so romantic and so interesting. And that's the way to approach the work. And now I'm just like, oh, I'd much rather just go home and watch TV.
Do you want to spend some time in the Ant-Man suit?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah, you know, look, I get it. Just tell me where to stand.
I just want to go look at House Hunters International and Zona.
I take the work just as seriously. I really do. I want to be just as good in the part as I could possibly be. But I don't think I have the concentration, wherewithal, ability or interest to just immerse myself in that world as to that extent.
I don't think you could do it without. I mean, I think it would have to be you have to be an incredibly selfish person because it would mean shutting out everyone else in your life.
Yeah,
and not being open at all. I mean, like, I'm going into this weird emotional cell and you can't come in for
I wonder months. How much is true versus how much is reported to be true as well.
Know.
Like, are they really like those, you know, the ones that are really hardcore about it? Are they?
I heard one time Daniel Day-Lewis fucked a puppy to death. No, I don't know. I'm just kidding.
Hey, just that's kidding. Not funny.
My father was a puppy. He got fucked to death. It's not cool.
I heard this story where there was this of an actor. I won't name who it was, but that he worked in this way and was playing somebody who was mentally retarded, who mm-hmm. actually had a learning disability, and spent like a month before shooting just walking around his neighborhood or just ever acting like he was mentally retarded.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, do you say, dude, just memorize the lines? You know, that just, is it offensive? Is
at
it,
that point, you
is
say,
it just,
look, Giovanni Ribisi, would you please?
You said it, not me.
I was just taking.
Ding, 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 ding.
Just taking my brain did this incredible CSI thing where it started cross-referencing every movie versus every actor that I would perceive would be capable of doing that, and it like that was where it went bleep, 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 bleep. And like if I had been like a 1940s like automat computer, it just like a card would have spit out. And that was
amazing. Might be rumor.
I mean, we don't know.
We don't know for sure.
We're not 100%. We don't know. But it does take a lot of energy and also it just, I don't know. It like that to me, maybe there are deeper psychological issues that where someone feels like I got to escape into this.
Yeah. And you know, and there's also, I mean, on the flip side, certainly, you know, there's no one way of working. There's no one way of doing anything. And I completely respect anyone's approach to do what it is that they do in the way that they need to do it. I mean, certainly, you know, the proof is in the pudding. These guys are incredible actors. They really are. So,
are you feeling good? Do you feel, do you sort of feel the weight and enormity of the fact that, you know, that you will get to be this character for a while now? I mean, or does it feel kind of comforting?
No, it feels all kind of new and just starting because people are seeing this thing now. They're just starting to anyway.
Yeah.
And beforehand, it's all just been, you know, in the abstract. we were shooting this thing, and it's like people would say, how does it feel to be in the Marvel Universe? But I didn't really feel like I was. There weren't any other people around. We were shooting this thing on its own. And then I went and worked on Captain America 3 a little bit.
Yeah.
And then some of the other Avengers were there. And then it was, oh, wow, this really did – it felt different and it felt real in a way that hadn't felt as real until that moment. But now – you know, we had this premiere last night and the whole street was shut down, and it's relative. It kind of comes in doses, and it's very exciting, but it's, you know, it can, I suppose it probably could be a little overwhelming if I stop and think about it for, you know, a few minutes kind of meditatively.
Did you, was there any point where you pinned down Michael Douglas and said, tell me what it was like to be famous in the 70s. Because I always just think of, like, that was the ultimate time to be young and famous. There were no rules about drugs or sex, or it was just like everyone was doing everything and fucking everyone. And it just sort of seemed like, yeah, that was the time, man.
Yeah, to kind of be an actor at that time and have that kind of, what a fun.
Just to be like
anything
at that time. A young, handsome, you know, like everything.
Right.
Like there was no social media.
Yeah.
No one's going to find out about anything. Like, it just seemed like it was a golden age.
Yeah. Yeah. It must have been. Right? I mean, it really must have been. You find that a lot of those guys, and I have worked with a few, where it's like, oh, they'll tell you stories.
Yes.
And when they do, you just kind of notice people stop working, even in the background who aren't supposed to be listening. It's just like, you know, they want to hear about just crazy stuff from the 70s or, it must have been awesome.
We were shooting on this playground and I put 8 ladies on a merry-go-round and spun it really fast and they all just tongue my balls and I was like, what are you talking about?
And they bring over bowls of cocaine for everybody.
Oh, yeah, we had cocaine bowls in those days.
They had a bowl of cocaine at the craft service table in those days.
I'll bet they did.
Everyone was given guns.
Especially the kids. God, it's just such a different, I don't know. The world's too delicate now. I think the world's slightly too delicate now.
It is, it is that thing, the like that book you're reading and... everyone's plays it safer. There's a political correctness. Everyone's being watched. Everything's, you know, being recorded and documented. And there are so many outlets now for things. It's probably less fun.
Yeah.
In general. I mean, not just for this, but like in life in a way, I think there's to be so kind of tied in and observed and knowing that everything is just documented and people are documenting their every move. A certain quality of life has been lost. That's why when I say George Carlin was my favorite comedian and is my favorite comedian, that was a huge part of what he talked about. This kind of, and it takes the edge off. He had that whole routine about shell shock. And how over the years it had been documented until finally it turned into post-traumatic stress disorder. You don't even know what it is. Shell shock, you got an idea. Like the description was in the word.
Right.
If maybe it was still shell shock, some of the soldiers who were suffering from it could actually receive some of the benefits that they so deserve. But, you know, he would break down that kind of stuff and it makes a lot of sense to me.
I think Carlin in today's world, if Carlin were coming up now, I think he would have a tough time. Because I think...
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, it's changed so much in the time that he died. I mean, and, you know, he died... This is weird that I take comfort in this, but I do. George Carlin, Paul Newman, and my father all died in the same year. And it's like, those are my three favorite guys. And they all died in the same year, and there's something nice about all of them going out together. And I feel like, you know, my dad loved Carlin, too, for those same reasons of just, like, yeah, he tells it like it is.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know what that means or what, but I like it that they all kind of, They all checked out together.
There's like, because you, in your mind, you can go like, they, you know, like they were kind of a group. Like they were sort of a.
I mean, it's like, well, I guess when it rains, it pours.
Yeah, yeah.
All three of them said, all right, we're done.
Fuck you, Paul.
Yeah. You're on your own.
And I'm taking Carlin and Newman with me.
Yeah.
Carlin, Newman, you're driving, obviously. Well, this has been so great to have you on the podcast. I just, you know, every time I see you, I always go, oh, that Paul Rudd's such a nice guy. I want to hang out with him more. And so I you know.
Well, same here, Chris. It's been great being here.
We're doing the thing tonight. We're doing a little periscopy thing tonight. We're going to hop in a van and drive around and take, there's an Ant-Man screening tonight at the Arclight.
Oh.
And so we're gonna just I guess just general fuck aroundery.
Great, perfect.
Yeah, it'll
that's
be good.
The best. That's the best kind of fuck aroundery. I think is the general kind.
I don't like to get too specific with fuck aroundery.
No.
Just like to keep it as broad as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Like it gives you just more room to fuck around.
That's right. Don't box me in.
Yeah.
This is like, I don't want to get into kind of like
very specific.
Yeah,
specific fuck aroundery.
No. It's just
I feel limited.
Yeah, I don't want to. It's lowest common denominator fight. It's the hee haw fuck aroundery. if that's possible. God damn you, Dad! Why did you do that to me? I still have old hee haw sketches that play in my head, like to my utter disdain. Like, why are you still in there?
No, once it gets in there, it's in there.
It burrows in there. Maybe someday I'll be comforted by it and go, ah, hee haw, they really knew what was up. But I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon. Paul Rudd, wonderful to see you. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies and brands to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.